Frank held his gun ready to try another shot, but the way the ravine ran such a jagged course through Ambush Valley, it was hard to catch more than a glimpse of his quarry before another bend in the trail hid McCoy from view again. When they did reach a relatively straight stretch, McCoy hipped around in the saddle and fired, forcing Frank to bend low over his mount's neck in order to make himself a smaller target. He wasn't hit, and his horse didn't break stride, so he assumed that McCoy's shot had missed entirely. More than that, it had also emptied McCoy's gun. Frank saw him jerk the trigger a couple more times, but no shot sounded. Frank lifted his Colt and squeezed off a shot. McCoy kept going without slowing down, and a second later was out of sight again as his horse pounded around a bend in the ravine. Frank didn't think McCoy would be able to reload, hang on to the loot, and control the horse all at the same time. McCoy would have to outrun him now, as they had outrun the Apaches together. Frank leathered his iron and concentrated on getting all the speed he could out of the horse. It was a wild ride through the ravine, with the sheer stone walls flashing past, sometimes close enough that Frank could have reached out and touched them. The pounding hoofbeats of his quarry's horse echoed back at him, and he was sure McCoy could hear the pursuit coming up behind him, too. Frank wondered just how long this slash in the earth was. As long as they were in it, McCoy couldn't do anything but keep moving forward with Frank behind him. The walls were too steep and high to let them out. But if McCoy reached a place where he could leave the ravine and make it out into the wilds of Ambush Valley, he might be able to give Frank the slip. Frank had to catch up to him before that happened. He saw McCoy up ahead again. The bank robber jerked his horse around a turn, and the animal's hooves suddenly skidded on the sandy floor of the ravine. The horse tried to recover its balance, but it was already too far gone. The horse went down, taking a heavy fall. McCoy was thrown out of the saddle. He sailed clear of the falling horse, crashed to the ground, and rolled over a couple of times. Amazingly, he still held onto the bundle of stolen money. Lashing his horse with the reins, Frank pounded closer as McCoy struggled to his feet. The outlaw turned to run, but it was too late. Frank was practically on top of him already. Frank left the saddle in a diving tackle. He crashed into McCoy from behind and wrapped his arms around him. Both men went down, but Frank landed on top with his weight driving McCoy into the ground. McCoy was a long way from beaten, though. He twisted around and brought his elbow back in a sharp blow that caught Frank on the jaw and rocked his head to the side. Frank smashed a clubbed fist into the side of McCoy's skull. They grappled and rolled over, each seeking even a momentary advantage. McCoy got one hand on Frank's throat and clamped down hard, but at the same time, Frank got his knee in McCoy's belly and heaved him to the side. McCoy's choke hold came loose. Frank sprang after him and landed another punch, this time on McCoy's mouth. Blood spurted from pulped lips. Like an old war horse answering the bugle, Frank swung again and again, pounding blows to McCoy's face and body, absorbing the punishment that the bank robber dealt out to him in turn. It was inevitable that a missed punch would end the fracas. McCoy's fist grazed past Frank's ear, throwing the bank robber off balance for a heartbeat. That was long enough. Frank's left shot forward in a short but powerful punch that stunned McCoy and left the outlaw unable to defend himself from the looping right that exploded on his jaw. McCoy landed on his back, his eyes glazing as they rolled up in their sockets. He tried to lift his arms, but they fell back weakly. After that, he didn't move, except for the ragged rising and falling of his chest. Frank was almost as bad off. One of the horses was close enough so that he could reach out, grab hold of the stirrup, and use it for support as he pulled himself to his feet. He leaned against the horse and tried to recover.
I know you can hear me, McCoy. It's over.
Frank leaned down, ripped the gun from McCoy's holster, and tossed it aside. The revolver was empty, but he didn't believe in taking chances.
You bastard. Wharton, I reckon you kill me now and take all the money.
Well, it's worse than that, McCoy. Worse for you, anyway. I'm taking you back to Yuma prison and returning the money to its rightful owners. Oh, and the name's not Morton. It's Morgan. Frank Morgan.
Frank Morgan? A gunfighter?
Used to be.
But You're in prison. You're rustling those cattle, kill that sheriff and his deputies.
That's what we wanted you to believe, so that you and I could break out together and you'd lead me to that money.
We?
Conrad Browning is my son.
McCoy stared at Frank in uncomprehending disbelief for a long moment, as if Frank had spoken in some language that the outlaw had never heard before. It was a bitter sound that rolled out of him as he lay there, beaten.
Get up!
McCoy rolled onto his side and slowly, painfully pushed himself to his feet. He swayed there unsteadily for a few seconds. The grin he directed at Frank was ugly as sin.
You know you'll never get me back to Yuma alive, won't you, Morton? I mean, Morgan.
Oh, you'll get there, all right.
Oh, the ride back's too long. Somewhere along the way, you'll let down your guard. And then, I'll kill you. Or make you kill me.
Well, that might be true, if the two of us were traveling alone.
What the hell are you talking about?
There'll be somebody waiting for us right outside Ambush Valley. You remember Abner Hoyt and the rest of the bounty hunters that captured you in Hinckley?
You bastard! They've been following us all along.
Ever since we escaped.
Frank hoped the bounty hunters were actually where he expected them to be and that nothing had happened to them. For now, that was what he wanted McCoy to believe, anyway.
Now mount up. We're going back to that water hole.
McCoy climbed onto his horse, his slow, awkward movements showing how much pain he was in from the pounding he had taken. Frank wasn't in much better shape himself, but he tried not to show it as he picked up the slicker-wrapped bundle, hung it from his saddle horn, and pulled himself up into the saddle.
I still don't understand. Those fights you had with Jessup, time you spent in the dark cell, all those bullets the guard shot at us, all seemed real to me.
It was real. We didn't want anything to tip you off that I wasn't an actual convict. Warden Townsend was the only one at Yuma who knew who I really was.
You could have gotten killed a dozen times over.
Yep, I reckon that's true.
You did all that just to get back some stolen money? Your boy means that much to you?
Conrad didn't want to let you get away with it. He thought there's a good chance you'd escape from prison sooner or later, grab that loot, and make it across the border where nobody could ever touch you.
I would have, too.
So we decided just to speed the process up a mite and send me with you. And I wanted to be sure you got what's coming to you, too, McCoy.
Talking about justice, aren't you?
It means something to some of us.
Then you're fools. There is no justice in the world on this strength. People don't get what they want, just hand it to them. They have to be strong enough to take it.
Some folks would rather work for what they want out of life.
Fools.
For a few minutes, the two men rode in silence back toward the pool of water and the remainder of the $80,000. McCoy broke the silence.
You know there's $80,000 in that bundle back at the pool, Morgan.
I know it.
You could turn around and head east with it. Nothing I could do to stop you.
And all I have to do is let you go, huh?
$80,000? That's a hell of a lot of money. Enough to keep a man living in high cotton for the rest of his life.
A dishonest man, maybe.
Hell, you're a gunfighter. Don't go getting all high and mighty and moral on me. How many men have you killed in your life?
None who didn't force me to it in one way or the other.
You've hired out your gun plenty of times. I heard about you, Morgan. You're nothing but a low-down killer. And now you're doing Browning's dirty work. You're just a hired gun for your own son.
You got that wrong.
The hell I do. So take the payoff, Morgan. Take the 80 grand. It's all yours. Just right away. You won't ever have to see me again.
Give it up, McCoy. What you're talking about isn't gonna happen. You're going back to prison where you belong.
Well, can't say I didn't give you a chance.
Frank and McCoy had reached the spring, collected the money, and quickly headed out of Ambush Valley. Frank had glanced at the bodies of the two men who had died here weeks earlier and wished that they could be given a proper burial. If he'd had a shovel, he would have put McCoy to work digging graves at gunpoint. But he didn't have a shovel, and he wasn't going to take the time to have the graves dug by hand. He wanted to get out of here and rendezvous with Hoyt's group, so he just had McCoy refill the canteens from the spring instead. Now they had reached the end of the ravine and were riding up the slope leading out of it. Frank looked at the arid, rocky wasteland that surrounded them and realized that he wasn't sure which direction they needed to go. McCoy had been here in Ambush Valley before and knew the way out a lot better than Frank did.
What are you gonna do now, Morgan? Maybe you can find the way out, maybe you can't. Could be we'll wander around in here until we starve or die of thirst. Just don't expect me to help you.
Frank thought he had a pretty good idea where to find the trail. Anyway, as long as they were moving in a generally westward direction, sooner or later they would come to the end of the valley. It might take longer if he had to hunt around for the way out, but they would get there.
That way. Get moving, McCoy.
Sure. If you're certain that's the right direction.
Frank and McCoy rode between a couple of towering spires of rock and through a field of scattered boulders that were nearly as big as houses. The landmarks looked familiar to Frank, and his feeling that they were going in the right direction grew stronger as they rode up a slope and then down from the ridge into another boulder-dotted flat. The green of vegetation was nowhere to be seen in this part of the valley, but there were plenty of other colors, the red, brown, and tan of sandstone, the gray of granite, even stretches of volcanic rock that were a deep black. Arching over all of it was a pale blue, cloudless sky dominated by the brassy orb of the sun, which beat down with increasing heat and strength. McCoy was starting to look a mite nervous as he glanced back at his captor.
You're looking a mite nervous, McCoy. I guess I chose the right direction after all.
$80,000 damn! That's almost $100,000, you stiff-necked son of a bitch! Take it! Just let me loose! I will not go back to Yuma!
Yeah, you will.
Sweat darkened both their shirts. Some of the salty beads were about to drip into Frank's eyes, so he sleeved them away from his forehead. McCoy reined in, turning his horse so that he faced Frank. The gun in the drifter's hand came up, and his eyes narrowed.
Whatever you're thinking, forget about it, McCoy.
I told you I wouldn't go. You're gonna have to kill me, Morgan. Because if you don't, I'm gonna kill you with my bare hands. I'm coming for you, you bastard!
Frank wondered if he could just wound McCoy. In the bank robber's weakened condition, and in this murderous heat, even the shock of a bullet might be fatal, even if the wound wouldn't be a mortal one under normal conditions. But if Frank had to, he would shoot.
Stay back, mister. Don't make me pull this trigger.
You've known all along you'd have to do it. After all, you're a hired killer, remember?
McCoy stiffened and lifted his reins. He was about to send his horse plunging at Frank's mount, and Frank was going to have to shoot him out of the saddle. Might have happened that way, too, if at that moment a furious volley of gunshots hadn't blasted through the scorching air of Ambush Valley as if a war had just broken out. Abner Hoyt and the rest of the bounty hunters had made camp within sight of the entrance to Ambush Valley the night before. As usual, Hoyt made sure that a couple of men were standing guard all night. The fastest way to get killed out here on the frontier was to be taken by surprise. Hoyt didn't like surprises. That was why he was glad when the night passed quietly. The next morning, as he hunkered down next to a small fire and sipped scalding hot coffee from a tin cup, he peered toward the place where the mountains petered out and Ambush Valley began.
Are we going in there, Abner?
Not unless there's some need for us to go in, and I don't reckon that's very likely.
What if Morgan needs help?
Morgan didn't strike me as the sort of hombre who'd need help with one man, even if that man is an ornery son of a bitch like Cicero McCoy. But if we hear any shooting in there, I reckon we'll have to go take a look. If we ride into the valley, can you find your way back out again, Joaquin?
Si. Don't worry about that, Abner. We won't get lost.
I never figured we would.
Hoyt had never liked waiting for anything. He was an impatient man by nature, even though his perilous profession had taught him to be less so. Sometimes, being able to just wait without making a move or a sound was what it took to save a man's life.
Bob, you and Joaquin keep an eye on the mouth of that damn valley. I want to know the second Morgan and McCoy ride out of there.
Okay, boss.
Well, old chap, I'm going to find myself a shady spot in this dreary hellhole and read a good book.
Hey, Bartholomew, have you noticed Mantee spending more time with the Coleman brothers lately?
Well, I can't for the life of me imagine what would make him do that. But now that you mention it, they have been quite chummy lately. Anything we should be concerned about?
I don't know yet. We should keep an eye on it just the same.
Will do, old boy.
Somebody should have been watching the other direction, Hoyt realized late in the morning, when he glanced to the west and stiffened as he saw a dust cloud boiling up from the desert.
Somebody's coming! Looks like it might be a lot of somebodies.
Everyone in camp was instantly alert. The Coleman brothers and Mantee put away the cards and forgot about their poker game. Leaf marked his place in his book and picked up his rifle instead. Bardwell and Escobar turned away from the mouth of Ambush Valley and instead looked out at the desert.
Ah, those Apaches are back!
There's a lot of dust for a dozen riders to be kicking up.
That's because there are 30 or 40 of them sons of bitches.
And the ones that ran off yesterday must have gone back to fetch some friends. We got a fight on our hands now, boys.
Yeah, and we can't take them out here in the open. Throw your saddles on your horses. We're heading for Ambush Valley.
Hurry, boys! Them engines can't be more than 5 minutes away, and they're riding fast!
Would you like me to stay here and pick some of them off while the rest of you skedaddle, Abner?
Hoyt knew that the Englishman was offering to sacrifice his own life to give the rest of them a better chance.
there's no need for that. We'll find us a place to fort up in there, and then you can pot shot those Redskins to your heart's content, Bart.
Very well.
There was no sense of panic about the bounty hunters, although Jack and Ben Coleman sent several glances toward the charging Apaches as they saddled up. The rest of the men just concentrated on the task at hand, their movements smooth and efficient. Within 2 minutes of Hoyt giving the order, camp was broken, the horses were saddled, and the men were ready to ride.
All right, let's go!
Yeah! Get him!
Jack, let's go!
Hoyt figured the Apaches were still at least a quarter of a mile away. He and his companions would have time to reach the valley. Once they got there, they would have a tough fight facing them, no doubt about that. The odds against them were steep, but not overwhelming. If they could find some good cover, they had plenty of food, water, and ammunition. They could stand off the renegades for a long time, and Hoyt was confident that with each attack, he and his friends would do more damage to the Apaches. Even with a big war party like this, the Indians might decide the price they'd have to pay to kill these white men was too high.
Find some good cover, boys!
Over here, Abner!
The bounty hunters didn't have the luxury of a long search for cover because guns began barking from the heights to the right and left of them. Hoyt didn't hear the shots at first, but he saw the spouts of dirt kicked up by the bullets as they plowed into the ground, and when he glanced up toward the rocky slopes, he saw puffs of gun smoke scattered across them.
It's an ambush! Get to the rocks!
A curse. Hoyt knew instinctively what had happened. While he and his men slept the night before, Apache warriors had crept past them and into the valley to take up positions on the heights. Then the rest of the reinforced war party had attacked this morning, right out in the open where they were plainly visible. And because of that, Hoyt and the rest of the bounty hunters had waltzed right into the trap set by the renegades. Ambush Valley was living up to its name once again. And just like 10 years earlier, unless some sort of miracle occurred, there was going to be a slaughter here. The sound of shots from not too far away took both Frank and McCoy by surprise, but that didn't last very long. McCoy lunged his horse toward Frank. Frank held off on the trigger and wheeled his mount aside just as McCoy leaped from the saddle. He lashed out with the gun and felt the barrel thud against the outlaw's skull. McCoy's momentum carried him on into Frank anyway. The collision knocked Frank out of the saddle. Both men fell to the ground, landing hard. McCoy was stunned from the blow to his head. Frank rolled away, came up on a knee, and pointed the gun at the bank robber. All the fight had been knocked out of McCoy, he saw. In fact, McCoy was unconscious. Frank knew that wouldn't last long. He leaped up and hurried to McCoy's side. He tore McCoy's belt from the loops on his denim trousers. Then Frank jerked McCoy's hands behind his back and quickly lashed his wrists together with the belt. He took rope from the saddlebag and tied McCoy's legs together.
What are you doing?
Tying you up so you'll stay put.
No. You damn!
I'll be back for you later. I've got to check out that shooting.
But what if you don't get back? You can't leave me like this!
Then you should wish me good luck, McCoy.
You damn back-shooting coward!
Frank didn't have time for this. He didn't want to resort to brutality against a tied-up prisoner, but there was just no time. With a quick swing of the Colt barrel across McCoy's skull, Frank bought himself some time. He was planning to come back for McCoy later, but just in case something did happen to him and he wasn't able to return, he had bound the outlaw loosely enough so that McCoy would be able to work his hands free sooner or later. Frank wouldn't condemn even a man like McCoy to a slow, lingering death in this hellhole by tying him so tightly that he couldn't get loose. Now Frank caught his horse and swung up into the saddle. He had his Colt and McCoy's revolver and both Winchesters. He made sure that all of the weapons were fully loaded before he set off toward the battle, following the sound of the shots. Frank's route led him past several other landmarks that were familiar from the journey into the wasteland. Frank was confident that he was headed toward the end of the valley. The shots became louder, and he saw a haze of powder smoke floating in the air ahead of him. He was getting close to the battlefield. He rounded a bend in the trail and saw the long, straight stretch that led between half-mile-long, finger-like ridges to the desert. This was the mouth of Ambush Valley, and the slopes overlooking it were dotted with gunmen hidden behind rocks and scrubby clumps of brush. As Frank reined in, he caught glimpses of bright red and blue here and there, and knew that the men on the ridges were Apaches. More renegades, these on horseback, were milling around at the end of the valley. Trapped between the ridges, pinned down by gunfire, and bottled up by the Apaches at the mouth of the valley, were Abner Hoyt and the other bounty hunters. Frank saw several of them crouched behind rocks as they tried to return the fire of the bushwhackers above them. Some of their horses were down, obviously shot out from under them, but Frank didn't see any human bodies. It was only a matter of time, though. Hoyt and his men were in a bad spot. None of them, white, Mexican, or Apache, had spotted Frank yet. He dismounted and left his horse tied to a jutting rock. Then, carrying both rifles, Frank began working his way toward the top of the ridge on the north side of the valley mouth. The firing continued as he made his way through the rocks and up steep slopes. From the sound of it, Hoyt and the others were putting up a good fight, and that was encouraging. Most of them were still alive. If Frank could help even the odds a little, they might have a chance to get out of this trap. He finally reached the top of the ridge and moved along it until he could see most of the Apaches who were hidden up here, pouring fire down at Hoyt and his men. Frank paused long enough to study the situation and pick out the order of his targets. Chances were, the Indians wouldn't notice the extra shots, and if he took them from highest to lowest, they wouldn't see their fellow warriors falling. He knelt, set one of the Winchesters beside him, and rested the barrel of the other one on a rock as he drew a bead. A moment later, he squeezed the trigger, and the crack of the rifle was followed by the sight of the renegade highest up on the slope, jerking under the impact of the bullet in his back, and then folding up in death. The killing was swift and merciless. Frank needed only one shot for each of the renegades he downed. He ventilated all the ones he could see, then started in on the ones whose position was marked only by puffs of powder smoke.
Abner! See what's happening up on the hill?
I see it, but I'm not sure I believe it.
Engines are dropping like flies up there. Who is it?
Don't know, old boy, but whoever it is a bloody good shot.
That must be Morgan. He's forcing them to get up and move positions. When they do it, take them out. Don't worry about the ones on horses. Get the ones Morgan is flushing.
The bounty hunters were good shots, too. And the renegades, who were attempting to move positions, were being taken out in short order. Slowly, the odds were beginning to become more even. Frank wondered if the Indians hidden on the south slope had noticed what was going on. He got his answer as bullets began to whistle around him. The first Winchester was empty, so he tossed it aside and snatched up the second one.
Well, Frank, they know you're here now.
Hunkering down in better cover, Frank opened fire on the warriors across the valley mouth. The air around him was filled with sparks and flying chips of stone, and the whine of slugs as they ricocheted from the rocks. But Frank wasn't fighting alone. As he saw several of the Apaches suddenly stand up, double over, and slide headlong down the ridge because his bullets had found them, the bounty hunters kept up their deadly accurate fire and took a toll of their own. Every time Frank's shots forced a renegade out of cover, Hoyt or one of the other men drilled him. After 5 minutes of intense firing, Frank estimated there were only three or four of the Apaches on the south slope who were still alive. The warriors on horseback realized that their plan was failing, too. They had been content for a while to sit back and let the riflemen hidden on the slopes kill the whites. But it hadn't worked out that way. The trap had been sprung, but somehow its intended victims were still alive. Seeing that, the infuriated Apaches charged toward the scattering of boulders where Abner Hoyt and his men had taken cover. Between Hoyt's crew and Morgan up top, the number of renegades have been drastically cut. But at least 24 Apaches still thundered toward the bounty hunters, and the surviving renegades on the south slope were still a threat, too.
Here they come, men! Let's let them have it!
Morgan's really cutting them down up there, boss.
Well, let's keep doing our part so we can thank him later.
Boss! Look at Morgan!
Well, by God, I never saw anything like that in my life.
Give them hell, boys!
Frank knew there was no time to reload the rifle. He dropped the Winchester he had just emptied, drew his Colt from its holster, and jerked the gun he had taken from McCoy from where he had tucked it behind his belt.
Here I come, you bastard!
With his hands full of six-gun, he stood up and started down the slope, bounding from rock to rock, sliding on his heels in places, and doing his best not to start tumbling out of control. Twice he felt bullets pluck at his shirt, and countless times they whispered to him as they went past his ears. But somehow, Frank reached the bottom of the ridge unscathed. The Apaches were almost on top of the bounty hunters by now. Frank saw Abner Hoyt desperately emptying a revolver at the renegade. The other men were fighting just as doggedly. Frank's revolvers began to boom and buck in his hands as he opened fire with them, squeezing off shots right, left, with deadly, cool-headed accuracy. Apaches flew off their horses as the drifter's bullets ripped through them. One of the Apaches dove off his horse and tackled Frank. They slammed to the ground and rolled over and over. Frank lost one of his guns, but both Colts were empty anyway. He used the one he still held to block the downward sweep of a knife as his enemy tried to gut him. Driving a fist into the Apache's face, Frank knocked the warrior backward. He crashed the barrel of the pistol against the Indian's head and felt the man's skull crunch and shatter under the blow. The Apache spasmed and lay still. Frank scrambled up in time to see three of the mounted renegades closing in on him. They were no more than 40 feet away, and the only weapon he had was an empty gun. Then, suddenly, a figure flashed between Frank and the Apaches. The man held a rifle, and it spouted flame as he opened fire on the renegades. The Apaches returned that fire, and the man who had intervened to save Frank's life, at least for the moment, jerked as bullets slammed into his body. He kept shooting, though, emptying the rifle, and the three Indians toppled off their horses, blood gushing from mortal wounds. Frank ran to the man who had saved him. He had seen the thick white hair and recognized it and the clothes, but he could hardly believe his eyes. He had left Cicero McCoy tied up, well out of harm's way. How in blazes had the bank robber gotten here in the thick of the fighting? And why had he saved Frank's life? Frank dropped to a knee beside McCoy and rolled the man onto his back. The front of McCoy's shirt was sodden with blood. He had been hit at least 4 times, but he was still breathing.
McCoy. Damn it, McCoy.
Morgan. I'm shot to hell.
Yeah, you are.
I told you. I wouldn't go back to Yuma.
That's why you did it? That's why you saved me?
Saved you. I didn't even see you. It's too much gun smoke and dust. I just wanted to get in some licks on those damn Redskins.
Well, I'd likely be dead now if it wasn't for you, McCoy. I'm much obliged.
You're not welcome, you son of a bitch. You stole my money. I got loose, came here to find you and kill you. Now you tell me I saved your life. Things just never work out.
He didn't finish the question. Instead, he shuddered and blood welled from his mouth, and the glassy sheen of death slid over his eyes. Cicero McCoy was gone. But, like he'd said before, at least he hadn't gone back to Yuma. Frank used a couple of fingers to press McCoy's eyes closed again, then lifted his head and looked around. He was aware that the shooting had stopped now, and he wasn't surprised to see Abner Hoyt and several more of the bounty hunters standing there watching him. All of them had bloodstains on their clothes, and some of them were leaning on their rifles, using them as makeshift crutches. But as more of the men limped up, Frank counted them and got 7. Hoyt's whole group had made it through the fight. Not without injury, of course, but at least they were alive.
McCoy's dead?
That's right. Reckon he won't serve out his sentence after all.
What about the money?
I got it.
Well, that's what we need for the reward, more than McCoy himself. I can't help but think that bastard got off easy, though. He should have spent the next 20 years behind bars in that damn prison.
Justice has a way of working itself out. We may not always like the way it happens, but sometimes it's out of our hands. What about the Apaches?
There weren't but 3 or 4 of them left alive. They let us shuck out of here. There was a heap of killing here today, Morgan.
Enough to last a long time.
Frank turned and started limping toward the place he had left the horse with that slicker-wrapped bundle of loot tied to the saddle. That was the reason they had all come here to Ambush Valley, which today had certainly lived up to its name. Over the years, Frank had seen dozens of border towns like Hinckley, Arizona Territory, maybe more. It was an ugly, squalid little place. But today, in some ways, Hinckley looked a mite like heaven. Old Cyrus Hinckley, the owner of the general store and the founder of the town, also had some medical training in his background. He patched up all the bullet holes and creases the bounty hunters had suffered during the battle with the Apaches. Hoyt and his men could have tended to that themselves, having some experience with such things, but Hinckley had whiskey on hand to douse the wounds before he bandaged them up, and for the bounty hunters to take a drink or two of as well. While Hinckley was busy with the injuries, the settlement's citizens crowded into the store. They had heard all the shooting in the distance and were full of questions, wanting to know what was going on. Several of them guessed that another Indian fight had taken place over at Ambush Valley, which was correct, of course. The outcome had been different, however. The Apaches had lost this time. There was nothing anybody could do for Cicero McCoy except bury him. And in this heat, his body certainly couldn't be taken back to Yuma just to be put in the ground. So the Mexican undertaker and his sons got busy digging a grave in the small cemetery behind the church. Frank was content to sit in the shade on the porch of the general store. Once he had locked the bundle of stolen loot securely in Cyrus Hinckley's big iron safe, which was the only one of its kind for 100 miles or more. Abner Hoyt came out of the store and sank down in the cane-bottomed chair next to the one in which Frank was sitting.
Well, you're the one who actually recovered the money. I reckon when you come right down to it, Morgan, you're the one who's got the reward coming.
Well, I'd be paying it to myself. Conrad Browning is my son, remember? I own a share in that bank, and most of his other business holdings.
Ah, and here I always thought you were just a drifting gun hand.
There was a time that's all I was, but no more.
Well, if you ever want to get into the bounty hunting business...
No offense, Hoyt, but I've been on the other side of that fence too many times to ever cross it on a permanent basis.
Well, I hope nobody ever puts a big price on your head again, Morgan. I'd hate to have to go hunting you.
But you'd do it, wouldn't you?
If the reward was high enough. Damn right.
Abner Hoyt leaned back in his chair and rubbed the hip of the pretty señorita sitting on his lap.
Yeah, you like that, don't you?
She giggled and turned so that the valley of her ample breasts was visible in the low-cut neckline of the blouse she wore. Now there was a valley where a man could pure D enjoy being ambushed, he thought. He'd had enough tequila to feel it, but he wasn't drunk. Hoyt knew his capacity quite well, and he hadn't reached it yet. He intended to, though. The job was over, and since McCoy was dead, they didn't even have a prisoner to worry about. They had spent the evening in the cantina, enjoying the tequila and the young women, filling their bellies with beans and tortilla and cabrito. On the other side of the room, Bartholomew Leaf was trying to learn how to play the guitar from the old man who usually played it there. At a nearby table, Bob Bardwell was flirting with a señorita of his own. Joaquin Escobar had already vanished with one of the girls who worked here in tow. The Coleman brothers and Deke Mantee were gone too. Hoyt hadn't noticed them leave, but they'd either slipped out with some women or gone in search of a poker game, he figured. Hoyt didn't know where Frank Morgan was either. He assumed that when they rode out for Tucson in the morning, Morgan would be riding with them. Hoyt didn't figure that Morgan would want to let that bank money out of his sight for very long, especially not after all the trouble he had gone to and suffering he had endured to recover it. A sudden frown made Hoyt's bushy eyebrows draw down. That loot was locked up in Old Man Hinckley's safe. But just how secure was that safe? Hoyt had to admit that he didn't know. The iron box had looked pretty sturdy, but there might be somebody in Hinckley who could bust the lock. Hell, a stick of dynamite could blow the door right off the safe. And it wasn't so big, the whole thing couldn't be picked up by several men and put in the back of a wagon so that it could be hauled off and opened at leisure. Maybe it would be a good idea to post guards in the store overnight, he told himself. Hoyt realized he should have thought of that earlier.
What is wrong, senor? You no like Juanita?
I like you just fine, honey, but all of a sudden I got other things on my mind.
Juanita will make you forget everything but her.
Not now.
He stood up quickly, causing Juanita to leap to her feet so that she wouldn't get dumped in the floor of the cantina. Her dark eyes flashed with anger. Hoyt didn't care whether she was mad or not.
Bob, Leaf, get over here!
What's up, boss?
Why the glum expression, old boy?
I'm starting to worry about that loot. I'm thinking maybe we should set up a watch for it overnight.
Here comes Deke. Looks sober enough to stand a watch.
Something's not right.
There's something going on over there at that store. That money's locked up, Abner.
I knew it. What's wrong?
Hell, maybe nothing, but Jack and Ben and I were on our way back down here when we spotted some hombres skulking around the back of the building. Looked like they were taking a wagon back there or something.
They're gonna steal the whole safe!
That's what we got worried about. I left Jack and Ben there to keep an eye on the place. Figured I better round up you and the rest of the fellas so we could get over there and put a stop to whatever's about to happen.
I don't know where Joaquin is, but I reckon the six of us can handle any trouble we run into.
Absolutely, old boy.
Let's go!
Abner Hoyt and the other three men quietly made their way to a shadowy doorway across the street from Cyrus Hinckley's general store, where the safe containing the stolen money was located.
Blasted! I left Jack and Ben right here to watch the place. Where'd they get off to?
Maybe they were afraid the men who were after the safe were going to get away with it before we got here. They could have slipped around to the back of the store to try to get the drop on them.
Yeah, that must be what happened. Yeah, we better get over there and see what's going on.
Be careful. We want to be sure what we're walking into.
He motioned for Leaf and Bardwell to go one way around the store, while he and Mantee went the other. With military-like precision, the men followed Hoyt's orders. The building was dark. Hinckley had already closed for the night. He probably didn't lock the doors when he left for the day. Most folks, even merchants, seldom locked their doors. That way, if somebody found themselves in need of supplies in the middle of the night, they could go in and take what they wanted and leave the money to pay for it. So the would-be thieves wouldn't have any trouble getting in, Hoyt thought. The only difficulty they would encounter would be in lifting the heavy safe and loading it into the wagon. Then they could drive away with it, and the $80,000 inside. As he and Mantee cat-footed along the alley beside the building, staying close to the wall, Hoyt listened for the sound of voices. He didn't hear anything. He stopped at the corner and pressed his back to the wall. Not far away, a horse blew through its nostrils and stamped a foot. Somebody was back there behind the store, all right. Hoyt risked the look.
And what do you see, boss?
There's a wagon with an open bed back there. The horse team's all hitched. They're ready to ride.
You see any people?
Not yet. Where the hell are they? Are they inside? Why didn't they leave the door open so they could drag the safe out?
Hey, what about Jack and Ben? You see them?
No sign of them either. Come on, take a closer look.
They approached the wagon slowly and carefully. Part of the way there, Hoyt spotted movement on the far side of the vehicle and stiffened. Then he heard a low whistle, indistinguishable from that of a night bird, and knew it came from Bardwell.
Bardwell and Leaf are in position.
With Mantee a few feet behind him, Hoyt reached the wagon. It was empty, except for some blankets thrown in the back. Hoyt frowned in puzzlement. He didn't like mysteries, and he couldn't figure this one out. Where were the men Mantee and the Coleman brothers had seen? For that matter, where were the Coleman brothers?
Bob, go see if the safe's still in the store.
Bardwell nodded and disappeared silently into the building. The rest of them waited for a long, tense moment until Bardwell stepped out into the alley again.
It's there, right where we left it.
No sign that it's been disturbed?
Nope.
And there's nobody around?
I didn't see anybody.
Hoyt knew that if there was anything important to be seen, Bardwell would have noticed it.
Damn, what the hell's going on?
Hoyt jammed his Colt back in its holster. Bardwell and Leaf leathered their irons as well, and Leaf tucked the rifle under his arm.
Some of us should stay here and guard the safe while the others search for Jack and Ben.
That won't be necessary. I know right where they are.
I thought you said...
Abner Hoyt stopped short when he realized that Mantee's gun was pointed at him. At that moment, the blankets in the back of the wagon were thrown aside, and the Coleman brothers sat up, with revolvers already clutched in their fists. They had Bardwell and Leaf covered before either of the bounty hunters could make a move.
Oh, hell, Deke.
Don't try for your gun, Abner. I know you're fast, but there's no way you can outdraw a gun that's already lined up on you.
You three are the ones stealing the money, aren't you? You brought the wagon back here to carry off the safe. There was never anybody else skulking around.
You're a smart hombre, Hoyt. But not so smart that you can see there's 80 grand here for the taking.
It's not our money.
And we'll be getting a reward, old boy.
A reward? Ha! A measly $9,000. There's 9 times that much in the safe.
It's not right. That money don't belong to us. We work for rewards, remember?
You mean we risk our hides for a piddling fraction of what we recover. Anyway, don't go getting high and mighty on me, Abner. I've ridden with you long enough to know that you'll run roughshod over anybody who gets in your way when you're after a bounty. You've bent the law more than once.
Yeah, bent it maybe. But I never broke it. Not like this. I never out and out stole.
Ho, it gets worse than stealing. We're gonna kill the three of you, too.
We talked about it. We decided we didn't want you boys trailing us. Only one way to make sure you can't.
It's not sporting. Not sporting at all. You're not giving us a fair chance.
I thought even a damn Englishman would know enough not to expect life to be fair.
If they were going to kill him and Bardwell and Leaf, Hoyt thought, they should have done it right away. Just gone ahead and pulled the triggers as soon as they had the drop on their intended victims. But since they hadn't, Hoyt thought it might be a good idea to try to keep them talking a little longer.
You know, Deke, just last night I started to wonder a little about you and these two, since you've been spending so much time together lately. I never really did trust Jack and Ben.
Yeah, well, we don't like you either, you son of a bitch.
But I put it out of my head and decided not to worry about it. You know why, Deke? Because I trusted you. I figured we'd been riding together long enough to know that you'd never try to double-cross me, even if you were tempted.
You figure wrong. It takes a lot to make me turn on a friend, but hell, Abner, 80 grand is a lot. More than 25,000 apiece.
Yeah, if those snake-blooded Colemans don't decide to turn on you too as soon as they got the money, they might plan on keeping your share as well as theirs.
Now that won't work, Hoyt. Deke knows we wouldn't do that. Hell, taking the money and killing you three was his idea.
Hoyt didn't want to believe it, but Mantee didn't deny it. Instead, the lean gunman just raised his revolver a little more. The slightest pressure on the trigger would send a bullet through Hoyt's brain.
Joaquin will hunt you all down. He won't let you get away with this.
We're not worried about Escobar. He's dead. I put a knife in his gut 15 minutes ago, before Deke ever came to the cantina to fetch you over here.
Hoyt felt despair well up inside him. It was an unfamiliar emotion, and it tasted bitter and sour under his tongue, the way defeat must taste.
Morgan will come after you. He's already gone through hell to get that money back. He won't sit back and let some no-accounts like you have it.
Yeah, well, that old man don't scare us neither. He's just a washed-up gunslinger. We can handle him. Shoot, Deke can take it.
Is that what you think, Deke? You reckon you can help draw Frank Morgan?
What I reckon is that we've all flapped our jaws more than enough. So long, Abner.
That was it, then. All that was left was for Hoyt to make a desperate grab at his gun and try to get it out and squeeze off a shot before he went down. Dying might not be so bad if he could get some lead in that traitor Mantee first. Like a burst of thunder, gunshots exploded in the alley behind Hinckley's store. Even in his younger days, Frank hadn't been much of one for carousing. He'd drink a beer or even a shot of whiskey every now and then, but for the most part, he preferred a good cup of coffee. And he had that after he finished up the meal he had ordered in the settlement's only cafe down by the church. The ordeal in Ambush Valley had left him famished, and it felt mighty good now to have a full belly. As he sipped the strong black brew from the cup, he reflected on his plans, which for now included sleeping the sleep of the just for, the next 10 or 12 hours. Then he thought about the money. $80,000 made a mighty tempting target, and nearly everyone in town knew about it, knew it was being kept in the store for the night. Hoyt must have told some of his men to stand guard over it, Frank thought. but as he cast his memory back over the events of the evening, he couldn't recall hearing Hoyt say anything about that. After emptying the cup, Frank laid a coin on the table to pay for his meal and stood up. It wouldn't hurt anything to take a walk down to Hinckley's store and check on the money before he turned in for the night. That way, he could be sure that nothing was going to happen to it. And if Hoyt hadn't posted any guards, then Frank would find him and see that it was done right away. Millions of stars glittered overhead in the clear air. The moon had risen over the mountains to the east and now cast its silvery illumination over the landscape. Frank was tired and sore, but he was satisfied with the way things had gone, other than Cicero McCoy's death. And Gideon's, he thought, remembering the man who had befriended him inside Yuma Prison. Suddenly, a dark shape loomed up out of the shadows and staggered toward him. Frank's instincts had the Colt out of its holster in less than a shaved whisker of time. He held off on the trigger, though, as a pain-racked voice came from the figure as a weak whisper.
Por favor, senor. Por favor.
What's wrong, son?
He could see now that the man had an arm pressed across his belly. The hombre stumbled again and almost fell.
Senor Morgan?
Escobar? What happened to you?
Senor Morgan, I have been stabbed.
Who did it?
Ben Coleman.
A shock went through Frank. Ben Coleman was one of the bounty hunters. Had he attacked Escobar in some sort of personal quarrel, or...
They are after the money. The Coleman brothers. And the Mantee.
Mantee was the lean, dark-faced gunman. Frank had seen Mantee watching him intently several times and recognized the look. Mantee had been wondering if he was faster on the draw than the notorious Drifter. Frank hadn't intended to find out the answer to that question. Now it sounded like he might not have any choice in the matter.
You must stop them, senor.
I intend to, but first we gotta get you some help.
Frank saw dark tendrils of blood snaking over Escobar's hand from the wound in his belly. Escobar was probably doomed, no matter what Frank did, but he wasn't going to give up on the man. Yellow light shone through the windows of one of the nearby houses. Frank led Escobar over to the dwelling and pounded on the door. A man with a white spade beard jerked it open a moment later with an ancient horse pistol in his hand.
What the hell's going on out here? Who are you?
This man's hurt. Take care of him. Make him comfortable and then go fetch Cyrus Hinckley for him.
What? Why, he's a greaser.
He's a friend of mine. Now do as I told you, mister.
Nobody in his right mind was going to argue with Frank Morgan when he got that tone in his voice. The old-timer set his pistol aside and reached out to help Escobar. Frank turned and ran into the night. He had to get to Hinckley's store before Mantee and the Coleman brothers could steal that money. It had been stolen once already, and Frank wasn't going to let that happen again. Not after everything he had gone through to bring it back. When Frank had reached the general store, he saw that nothing was going on in front of the store. The place had looked quiet and dark and peaceful. But Frank knew that looks could be deceptive, so he had slowly worked his way to the rear of the building. Now, Frank stood, taking in the ugly scene in front of him. Deke Mantee had his gun pointed at Hoyt, while the Coleman brothers stood in a wagon parked nearby, covering Bob Bardwell and Bartholomew Leaf. Colt flame bloomed in the shadows as Mantee fired. Hoyt was moving even as Mantee squeezed the trigger. He wasn't fast enough to avoid the bullet entirely. Probably nobody alive would have been. The slug hit him in the shoulder and slewed him halfway around. He fell to one knee as he continued trying to claw his gun from its holster. In the instant after Mantee fired, Frank shifted his aim to the two men in the wagon. The Coleman brothers hadn't triggered their guns yet, but they had Bardwell and Leaf dead to rights. Frank's Colt bucked twice as he smoothly squeezed off the shots. Even in this relatively poor light, Frank's accuracy was astonishing. Jack and Ben Coleman went over backward as the bullets punched into them, toppling them from the wagon bed to the ground. Jack was dead before he landed, with a bullet in his heart. Ben took a few seconds to die, drowning in his own blood from the slug that had ripped through his lungs. Mantee whirled when he heard the pair of shots behind him. His reactions were fast. Frank had to give him that. Mantee's gun blasted and sent a bullet whistling past Frank's ear. Frank fired back at him, but Mantee was already moving. He lunged to one side, looped an arm around the neck of the wounded Abner Hoyt, and hauled Hoyt to his feet. Frank had to hold his fire, as did Bardwell and Leaf. Frank couldn't risk a shot as long as Mantee was using Hoyt as a shield.
Damn you, Mantee! Ugh.
Hoyt fell silent as Mantee ground the barrel of the gun against his head.
Drop it, Morgan! Bardwell, Leaf, you too!
Don't pay any attention to him! Shoot the son of a bitch! Shoot through me if you have to, but kill the backstabbing bastard!
They won't do that, Abner, and you know it. Bardwell and Leaf are your friends, and Morgan's not the type to shoot an innocent man.
You might as well give up. None of us are going to drop our guns, and you know you can't just walk away from here, Mantee.
Mr. Morgan is right, Deke. We'll hunt you down. All of us.
You killed Joaquin!
I didn't kill anybody. Ben's the one who knifed Joaquin.
Frank started to move closer to Mantee. The gunman had too much to think about to notice that Frank had cut the distance between them in half.
Escobar's not dead. He's the one who told me what was going on over here.
Not dead? Damn it, those Colemans couldn't do anything right. I should have had better partners.
You should have been a better partner. You never should have double-crossed us, Deke.
$80,000! You didn't give me any choice!
Frank had gotten close enough now to see the panic in the young gunman's eyes.
Now you gonna let me go, or do I blow his brains out?
You pull that trigger and you'll be dead a second later.
No doubt about it.
Mantee's head moved with a jerky desperation as he looked at Frank, Bardwell, and Leaf. He had to know that things had gone too far south to salvage now. His allies were dead, and he was faced with three utterly deadly enemies. But he wasn't willing to surrender. Even in the moonlight, Frank could see that. So he wasn't surprised by what Mantee said next.
I'll holster my gun! If you holster yours, Morgan!
You want to draw against me?
Damn right! I've been hearing about you for years, about how fast you are. Reckon I'm gonna have to see that for myself.
Morgan, don't!
Accepting Mantee's challenge would get Hoyt out of harm's way. And either way, no matter what happened in the showdown, Mantee wouldn't escape. The surviving bounty hunters would see to that.
All right. Now it's your turn, Mantee.
For a second, Frank thought the gunman was just going to turn the pistol away from Hoyt's head and try to shoot him while his Colt was holstered. But then Mantee dropped his arm and pouched his gun, just as he'd said he would. He gave the wounded Hoyt a shove that sent him stumbling toward Leaf and Bardwell, then turned so that he faced Frank head on. His hand hovered over the butt of his gun, ready to hook and draw.
All right, Morgan. Whenever you're ready.
You got it to do, Mantee.
Mantee's hand flashed toward his gun in a stabbing draw. He was fast, the fastest of all the group of bounty hunters he had betrayed. But Frank Morgan was the drifter. Frank's Colt boomed while Mantee's gun was still coming up. Mantee took a fast step backward as the bullet hit him. He stayed on his feet and tried again to lift his gun, gasping for breath as he struggled against the suddenly heavy weight. Frank fired again, and this time the slug took Mantee in the forehead and exploded on through his brain, bringing oblivion crashing down on him for good. Calmly, Frank lowered his gun and began to reload it. The threat was over. But a wise man kept one chamber empty for the hammer to rest on, and the others full of steel-jacketed death. The three bounty hunters looked at Mantee's body for a second, then came toward Frank. Leaf helped the wounded Hoyt.
You said Joaquin is still alive?
He was a few minutes ago, but he was hurt pretty bad. I hope Cyrus Hinckley has tended to him by now. Abner's shoulder could use some looking after, too.
Yeah, it hurts like a son of a bitch. We'll go fine, Hinckley, but somebody needs to stay here at the store and keep an eye on that loot.
I'll do that. I don't think anyone else will try to bother it.
Nah, I don't reckon they will.
A week later, Frank lowered the slicker-wrapped bundle onto the desk in the office of the manager of the First Territorial Bank in Tucson.
Here you go. It's all there.
I never doubted that it would be.
You'll see to it that Hoyt and the rest of the other fellas get the rest of the reward they got coming to them?
Of course. But I'd say that you deserve it as much as they do.
I don't need it. And that'd be a mite silly, don't you think? Paying myself a reward that way?
Well, I suppose so. What about you, Frank? I know the time you spent in Yuma had to be terrible, and there was all that trouble after you and McCoy escaped. Are you all right?
Frank considered the question. He was well rested. He had taken his time making the ride back from the border settlement of Hinckley, delaying his departure for several days until he was sure that Abner Hoyt was going to be all right. Mantee's bullet hadn't broken any bones, but Hoyt had lost quite a bit of blood. He'd been bouncing back nicely, though, by the time Frank had left town. Surprisingly, Joaquin Escobar had pulled through, too, and although it would be a good while before he fully recovered from the knife wound Ben Coleman had given him, at least he had a strong fighting chance to do so. Hoyt and the others planned to bring him to Tucson when he was strong enough to travel in a wagon. Frank would have brought the money back to Conrad by himself if he'd had to, but a couple of days after the shootout, a patrol of United States cavalry from Fort Grant had shown up in Hinckley looking for him. Conrad's status as a financier and highly successful businessman meant that he had numerous influential friends in Washington, so he had pulled some strings and gotten the War Department to order out that patrol. The troopers had accompanied Frank to Tucson, ostensibly because of the continuing threat of Apache excursions across the border. Frank knew the soldiers were really there to protect the money. After the last war party to cross the border had gotten whipped so thoroughly, he thought it might be a while before any more renegades ventured north from their mountain strongholds.
I'm fine. I reckon I'll be moving on.
Back to Buckskin?
That's right.
Back home, Frank thought. Then felt surprise go through him as he realized that he truly did consider Buckskin his home now.
And you'll be heading for Boston? You've been away for quite a while.
Yes, but I don't believe that Rebel has missed it very much. My wife isn't that fond of life in a big eastern city.
I don't figure she would be, growing up out here on the frontier like she did.
It's not really the frontier much anymore, though, is it? But with the progress civilization has made and all.
Frank thought about the way he had spent the past few weeks, the danger from outlaws and Indians, the wasteland that was Ambush Valley.
For some of us, it'll always be the frontier.
I suppose so. At any rate, I don't think Rebel is ready to return to Boston just yet. And as it happens, there's a troublesome situation regarding the Browning mining interests in the area around Buckskin. So, what I'm trying to ask, Frank, is how you'd feel about having some company on your journey back to Nevada.
Frank didn't even have to think about it.
I reckon that'd be just fine, son. Just fine.
The Last Gunfighter, Ambush Valley, is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 2008, William W. Johnstone. Published by arrangement with Kensington Publishing Corporation. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2010, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Ken Jackson, James Konacek, Thomas Penny, Johann Detweiler, Eric Messner, Andy Clements, James Lewis, Tom Simpson, Dylan Lynch, Mort Shelby, Richard Rowan, Terrence Hazelford, Joe Brack, Ren Casey, Stephen Carpenter, Tim Carlin, Casey Platt, Colleen Delaney, and Nanette Savard. Directed by Ken Jackson. Book adapted for graphic audio by Jimmy Payne. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Temeskin Wapner and Nathaniel Perry. Original music by Johann Detweiler and Brian Patton. Title theme by Johann Detweiler. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. If you enjoyed The Last Gunfighter, be sure to look for the series A Town Called Fury, as well as Smoke Jensen the Mountain Man, The First Mountain Man, and Sidewinders. Available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Read the Pinnacle Edition. Visit www.kensingtonbooks.com. Keep listening for previews of other thrillers in graphic audio.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
This blood brothering between you, Prince Midalis, and you, Chieftain Bruinhelda, will be the first in over a decade. You are not to harm the Shaggoth in no way, not even at the cost of your own life. Not that you could bring harm to the great beast anyway. Not even if you brought fine weapons in there with you. This is a test of your courage, not your warrior skills, and a test of your trust in each other. If either of you fails, then you both will surely die, and horribly. Are you prepared to begin?
What are you about, Elf? Are you going to tell me or not?
You take care, Bradwarden. On the South Road, I heard rumors of the Rosy Plague.
Oh, by the demons, you say?
I know not if there's any truth to those words. More likely, they were the utterances of a gossiping fool and nothing more. But I can ill afford to take the chance, any chance, of bringing the plague back to my people. Know that if the land becomes ill with plague, the Tuelalfar will secure our borders, and none will leave for many years. Farewell.
It is the plague! It is confirmed, my king! The Rosy Plague! What are we to do?
What can we do? Lock our doors fast and tight.
Oh, but where are you then? You've not been out of your walls in days! In weeks! Are you just to sit in there and let us all die then? Are you just to stand on your walls and shoot us dead if we come too close? And you're calling yourself the Folk of God? But you're just a pack of scared dogs, Yar!
Join with us before all the world has fallen into darkness. Help us put the church aright and thus end the misery of the plague.
You believe the plague to be a punishment from God?
On those who have forsaken the truth.
Absurd.
Obvious. I see it, and they see it. We know the truth, and we know the source, and no edicts from Father Abbot Agrangere will sway us from that path.
You risk the wrath of Father Abbot Agrangere and all the masters of St. Mirabel.
And you, Brother Glendonhawk, risk the wrath of Marcalo de Unaro. Which of us, then, do you believe in the worst situation?
You have gone mad.
As much has been said of many prophets. If you try to stop us, you may prove victorious, but I warn you that I will come for your throat first and foremost.
Experience the latest chapter of the Demon Wars saga in graphic audio. Don't miss Mortalis Part 2, available now.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets that include 5 books of a series, available only at www.graphicaudio.net.